Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us on this call. Many people that suffer from anxiety have a fear of flying. I'm always searching for the best information to pass on to those people, and when it comes to the fear of flying programs, the very best I've come across is the SOAR Fear of Flying program, created by Captain Tom Bunn, who is joining us on the line today. Now, Captain Tom Bunn, an airline captain and licensed therapist, is president and founder of SOAR. He's helped thousands of people to overcome their fear of flying with a therapy that he believes has now made it possible for everyone to fly. Welcome, Captain Tom Bunn.
Okay, thanks very much, Barry.
Can you start by telling us about your background and how SOAR came about?
Well, it started actually with the course at Pan Am that another pilot began, Captain Truman Slim Cummings, back in 1975. The program was actually given both in the United States and in England. The BBC did a feature on him back in those days. And the program was based on information about how flying works with the idea that knowledge is power. Many pilots believe that if you simply know how safe flying is, that's all it takes, but there's more to it than that. There's a psychological component. You can know everything about how flying works and still have reactions to being on the plane when the door is closed and you can't get out, or when you hear a noise, or when the plane makes a certain movement, particularly a dropping motion. Those things just like knee-jerk reactions. They just cause feelings to be produced. And so the program at Pan Am really didn't address that. Now, they tried to. They said, okay, here's relaxation exercises. Use these. But the problem is this. The amygdala, that's the part of the brain that releases the stress hormones, which, of course, the stress hormones cause the feelings. Mm-hmm. So the amygdala, its job is to react whenever it's aware of something that's non-routine. Does matter if you're relaxed or not. It's still going to do its job. So relaxation exercises don't, they may help on the ground for certain things, but they don't help at all in the air. Your amygdala is still going to react to the same things, relaxed or not. So I asked Slim about adding some cognitive behavioral techniques to his program. I was working with him on his program, and it never happened. So in 82, I set up SOAR and added the cognitive tools, and I thought that was going to be the solution, and it did help. It helped people whose anxiety develops slowly enough that they can use those tools, but it didn't help people whose anxiety just comes on at lightning speed. And for many years, we had no way to deal with that. And finally, I think by just dumb luck as much as anything else, there was something that I was doing and realized that it was working, didn't really know why. But after experimenting with it, it turns out that there are certain experiences between human beings that will temporarily cause the amygdala, that part of the brain that releases stress hormones, temporarily cause the amygdala to just take a break. And to give you an idea, it's, for example, when someone looks at you in a romantic moment like you are the only person in the world, the amygdala is saying, well, look, I'm not going to give you fear now and make you run away from this good situation. So the amygdala just shuts down. And frankly, it has a lot to do with our ability to reproduce, that the amygdala can shut down in moments when we feel safe with another person enough to become totally safe with another person and get very close. So we look for a moment that the amygdala will respond to another person's face. We look for that face that tells us that we're really thoroughly safe. And by the way, a lot of us don't have such good experiences with other people. And there's actual research that shows that if you don't have a good relationship with a person that will do this, you can use a dog. When a dog looks at us in that way that they're so devoted, more devoted than people, no doubt. When the dog looks at us that way, we produce an anti-anxiety hormone called oxytocin. And oxytocin shuts down the amygdala. So basically, we're looking for a moment that's going to shut down the amygdala. Once we find it, then we want to link the various things that happen on a flight to that, so that as those things happen on the flight, the amygdala doesn't react. No amygdala response, No hormones, no hormones, no fear. That's the answer.
So the key then is really working with the amygdala and learning or teaching a person to feel safe and feel comfortable while in flight, correct?
Yeah, we train the amygdala not to react. Mm-hmm. For example, if you think about a moment when you know, sometimes we say a person's eyes or person's face can say things that words can't say. That's the kind of moment we'd look for. Personally, when I think about my wife's eyes when we were taking wedding vows, that moment really reaches me. So if you've got a moment when that eye contact with another person and their face showed you unquestionably that maybe in other moments they didn't feel that way, but at least in that moment they did, that's what we need to grab. That's what we need to grab. And we then use that moment, because that moment shuts the amygdala down, and we link flying to it or elevators to it or whatever you need to link to it to control the emotions. So in a way, we're not really teaching the person not to be afraid. We're teaching the amygdala not to react, because if the amygdala doesn't react, you're not going to feel the fear.
Okay. And because, you know very well, when a person is, you know, has a fear of flying, they can have a very, you know, extreme state of panic while, you know, during yeah. taxi, takeoff, and all the different phases of flight. Mm-hmm. So this approach yeah. is really, you know, it's disempowering that fear, and it's really helping them to just feel, okay, so you're saying there may be an element of fear there, but they'll feel so much more relaxed than they normally would. Is that right?
Well, one of the interesting things that came out recently, if you search Google with these three words, amygdala, no fear, you'll find a story about a woman who had a rare disease that destroyed her amygdala. And the researchers, when they studied her, found that there was absolutely nothing that they could expose her to that caused her to feel fear. And even while they were doing the research on her, she was held up at gunpoint, and she just talked to the guys like they were just buddies of hers. She cannot feel fear. So now they had theorized that the amygdala was important, but now they know for sure that the amygdala is key. If the amygdala is not going to produce stress hormones, you're not going to feel fear. Now, we don't want to take away, you know, a person's amygdala. We need the amygdala, but we need it not to overreact. We need it not to react when the door closes. We need it not to react when the plane feels like it's dropping, and so on.
Mm. Yeah, I was reading some other research on the amygdala not so long ago, which suggested that the amygdala has lots of connections. The amygdala, located in our midbrain, has lots of connections to our forebrain, one-way connections, you know, preparing us for, mm-hmm. for fight and flight and for the emergency response. Mm-hmm. But in the reverse, there aren't as many connections. So from our forebrain or our conscious awareness, it's quite hard to communicate that back, to communicate back to the amygdala through thought and reasoning and logic.
Right. It doesn't do it through cognitive ways as well as we might hope it does. Mm-hmm. But there's one particularly beautiful, remarkable connection between the cortex and the amygdala, and that's the medial prefrontal orbital cortex. The CEO's office of the brain is in the prefrontal cortex. And there is a direct link between that part of the brain and the amygdala. And here's what happens. People say, hey, when I'm in control, I don't feel anxiety. There's a reason for that. And it's not exactly control. It's when you are in a situation where you can take action. At the moment you make the commitment to take a specific action that you think is going to work out for you. At the moment of commitment, a signal goes directly from the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala and says, hey, this is a done deal. I've decided what I'm doing. This is what I'm doing. Shut up and don't bother me. Mm-hmm. So people will sometimes say, how is it I can't get on an airplane and fly, but I can ride a motorcycle, I can do skydiving, I can do skiing, I can do rock climbing, I don't feel anxious. It's because of this. When the the amygdala is there for a reason. It's supposed to give you a shot of stress hormones anytime you run across something non-routine, because you need to take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And now the amygdala can't do anything more than that. It can only say routine or non-routine, routine or non-routine. So when it finds something non-routine, it releases the stress hormones and forces your high-level thinking to drop whatever it's thinking about and pay attention to this thing. Okay, you've got three steps now that your high-level thinking in the cortex is supposed to do. One, make an assessment. This non-routine thing could be an opportunity. This non-routine thing could be totally irrelevant. This non-routine thing could be a risk. What is it? Okay, let's assume it's a risk. Second step, what are you going to do about it? Once you come up with a plan of action, then the next step is to commit to that point, that plan of action. And it's at the moment of commitment to the plan of action that the signal goes from the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala system. Don't need any more stress hormones. You're getting in my way. Leave my mind clear to carry out this plan. It's beautiful. The problem is this. When you're in the, let's say you could ride in the cockpit of the airplane. It would work. You're sitting in the cockpit. You hear a noise. You get a shot of stress hormones. How do you assess the situation? Easy. Look at the captain's face. The captain looks like, no big deal. Aha, that's your assessment. Okay. Now, in this case, the assessment says irrelevant. What's your plan of action? I don't need to do anything. What's your commitment? Your commitment is to simply sit there. When you make that commitment, then the amygdala gets the message that it doesn't need to produce stress hormones anymore. But look at the situation in the cabin of the airplane. You hear that noise, and you don't know what it means, and you don't have anybody you can ask. Some people look at the flight attendant, but what do they know? Mm-hmm. You can't come up with an adequate solution to the problem. You can't be sure that it's really irrelevant. So if you can't come up with a good assessment, how are you going to come up with a good plan of action? And if you can't come up with a plan of action that you're confident about, you're not going to commit to it. And so when you don't make the commitment, you get stuck with the anxiety. Now, remember that the amygdala's job is, when it gives you the anxiety, to make you pay attention to something. If you can't get to commitment, the amygdala keeps producing anxiety, which keeps you focused on this thing. So you get locked onto it and you can't get away from it.
Yeah. That's interesting, because in the program I teach, Panic Away, it's a similar idea. You're basically getting the person to commit to a paradoxical approach, the approach of, you know, to mm-hmm. bring on the anxiety, to make the anxiety worse. And mm-hmm. that commitment then helps people to end their anxiety issue or their panic disorder.
Exactly, because almost all the time they're afraid it's going to get worse. They're afraid it's going to get worse. They can accept the level they're at if they knew it wasn't going to get worse. So you say paradoxically, okay, make it worse. That's your strategy. And when they find out they can't make it worse, coupled with the fact that they now have committed to action, it works beautifully.
Mm. It's really interesting, the therapy side of it, and this developed, you went back to study therapy even after the first fear of flying program, isn't that right? And then to develop your own program better?
Yeah. The first thing I tried was neuro-linguistic programming. I studied a year of that. I was really disappointed that I didn't find anything that useful in NLP. And I know there are people out there, you can see them on the internet, that say, you know, do NLP, it'll cure you. Well, look, I did a year of it, and it didn't work. I hired two of the very best NLP practitioners in the U.S., and we worked with people in one case over a weekend and one case once a week for 6 weeks, didn't get the results. So I have a hard time believing that NLP is going to be effective. It was kind of by accident. There is a thing in NLP they call the circle of excellence. And the idea is that you look at the floor in front of you and you draw an imaginary circle. And in that imaginary circle, you put your ideal self, the person you really want to be. And then you study that person, you step into the circle, and you beat that person. So that was one of the things I was trying from NLP. So I was at an airport with a woman, and I figured I would try this with her. And she stepped into the circle, and she was stepping from one foot to the other. And I thought, hey, she's not following my instructions. She's stepping from one foot to the other. I'm not just standing there being her ideal self. I said, what are you doing? And she says, I'm running a marathon. I'm a marathon runner. So that's why I'm stepping back and forth. I thought, oh, my God, that's interesting. So then I had this, I don't know where it came from. I said, okay, let's pretend as you're running the marathon that you're the door's closing on the airplane. And that as you're running the marathon, there's turbulence. And so we hooked up these things to the marathon running. And she got pretty good results. So then the next thing I tried was I had a woman who was an equestrian, and I said, okay, when you come up to the jump with your horse, just pretend that there's a photograph just before the jump, a black and white photograph of a plane taking off. And then as you come up to the jump, you see the photograph and you go across your jump. Of course, you can't see the photograph anymore. See, I was trying to figure, we go from the bad thought to the good thought. And we did this with a number of flight situations, and I thought this was going to be perfect. She reported back to me she's got no help at all. So we went through the exercise, set it up all over again to make sure it was set up right, same results, no good. Meanwhile, and this one I think you'll love, a woman said, I'm going to link it to breastfeeding my child. My thought was, oh, my God, she's going to get on the plane and think I'm never going to see my kid again. Mm-hmm. Instead, what happened was she called back and said she was on the plane and had not one bit of anxiety at all. And I didn't understand, but now I do. When you breastfeed a child, huge amount of oxytocin is produced. Mm-hmm. Oxytocin is a powerful anti-anxiety hormone. It shuts down the amygdala totally because, after all, the woman's got to sit there and be mellow and be able to do this for an extended period of time. So that's why that's one of the reasons why we have oxytocin produced to nurse the child, and of course, as I mentioned before, even to mate. So it's very tied into our biology and reproductive biology. So when I kept trying it, and I found out that every time we linked flying, moments of flight to a moment of breastfeeding, it worked beautifully. And there are some other moments, as I mentioned, anytime a person makes that eye contact with you, that you're really safe. It's beautiful. We just link those things to the various moments of flight, and a person gets on the flight and they just don't know where the anxiety went.
And, you know, you get great results with the SOAR program. Do you reckon that it's primarily because of this work, because of the connection oxytocin and the amygdala and the techniques you're using there?
What I gather, having played with this for so long and what I've been reading about oxytocin, is it may be that oxytocin is the key, but it may be that the amygdala will shut down without oxytocin. I don't know. There's some fascinating research about smiles and how we react to smiles. When another person smiles at you, it triggers an involuntary response in you to mimic their smile. And when you mimic their smile, there's two things that could happen. You mimic their genuine smile, or you mimic their best fake smile, their social smile. Okay. Yeah. There's a remarkable difference, although it's subtle, between a social smile and a genuine spontaneous smile. Mm. For example, there's certain muscles in the face that will operate involuntarily when you have a genuine smile. You can't make those muscles work except involuntarily. I'll give you an example. Right by the eye, and you probably see this if you think about it, there's some tiny little lines that kind of form a V right to the outside edge of the eye when a person smiles genuinely. Okay, what happens is you can't make those muscles contract consciously, but they will contract unconsciously when you're delighted. So let's say a person is delighted that's looking at you, they flash you this genuine, spontaneous smile of delight. Those muscles contract. You then are involuntarily caused to mimic a genuine smile. Your muscles there involuntarily contract. They're associated with good feelings. Therefore, you get good feelings. That's how you know a smile is genuine. So if you think about how remarkably dynamic the amygdala is in responding to people's faces, it's very possible that the amygdala just sees the, what it's looking for in another person's face and says, oh, I just fell in love. I love this person. I feel totally safe with this person. It could be that, or it could be oxytocin, or it could be both.
Yeah, interesting. Now, the other side of the program deals with the mechanical side of flying, because that also helps a lot, doesn't it? I mean, once people are more aware of the functioning of the planes, the different aspects to it, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you do have to deal with both parts. You deal with the emotional part, which we've talked about, and the intellectual part is, you know, is flying really okay anyway? And from a pilot's point of view, you don't see pilots leaving the job because they're concerned about safety. They feel so much more in control in an airplane than they do in their cars because, for example, if you're driving down the road and an engine quits on your car, you know, you're going to have to call a tow truck. So, but with an airplane, you've got two engines at least. So right there is a huge difference in the feeling of security and safety with an airplane versus a car. But with an airplane, you've got backup systems for everything you're going to need. You have backup radios. You have backup hydraulic systems. For example, when you land a 767, on left wing, there's four tires under the left wing, there's four tires under the right wing, so that's eight tires. Each one of those tires, unlike your car, has an anti-skid system. Guess what? Not just one, two anti-skid systems. So when you put the gear down, there's a self-test of all the anti-skid systems. All, let's see, 16 anti-skid systems. And if there's a fault at any one of them, the computer automatically switches from, let's say that there's in each wheel there's an anti-skid system that's the A system and an anti-skid system that's the B system. So what happens is it switches to just the A's, figuring that there's a 50-50 chance that you're going to eliminate the problem. Okay, and if it does eliminate the problem, the pilot's not even informed. The anti-skid's going to work beautifully, and you go ahead and land the plane. Now, if the system automatically switches over to the A systems only, and it doesn't clear the problem, must be in the B system, a light comes on and the pilot pushes a button that switches to the B system. Mm-hmm. And if that cures the problem, fine, you're okay. But rather than go on and on about this, there's two more steps that you can do to try to clear out your anti-skid problems. And finally, if you can't, you just land the plane without anti-skid, and just as you would in your car if you didn't have anti-skid, you'd be careful about the braking. And the thing about this is, you know, all the years I flew the 767, I never saw even go to the first step in the backup systems, but you've got five levels of backups there. Mm-hmm. And so that's why pilots feel so confident about the safety of the plane. You've got the primary systems, which work beautifully, and once in a while you switch to a secondary system, and it works just as well.
And you've got to talk briefly about turbulence. I've heard you talk about it before. I think it's wonderful, because a lot of people are afraid of turbulence and they don't understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a complicated thing, because first of all, I think that emotional part of the brain is the right side of the brain, which is also the visual part of the brain. And visual logic is, we could say, seeing is believing. You look up in the sky, you don't see anything holding that plane up. It's like, this doesn't make sense. It should be falling, but it's not. So already the right brain, the emotional brain, is just spring-loaded to the plane's going to fall out of the sky thinking. So all it takes is just the slightest little bit of turbulence to say, here it goes. So I think that's where people start out. It's just really hard to believe the plane should stay up there anyway. That's where we get into that Jell-O video that's available on the website for free, because it's so helpful for so many people. And the idea is that if you have some, I know you guys call it jelly or gelatin.
Yeah, that's right, jelly.
Jello is a brand name, but gelatin or jelly. And so if you have a plate of that and maybe some fruit in it, if you pick up the plate and shake the plate left, right, up, down, the fruit will move, but there's nothing you can do to make it fall. So the reason for talking about jelly is this, that when you get a plane going down the runway, when you get around 120, 130 miles an hour, the air is, as far as the plane is concerned, it's as thick as jelly. That's what holds the plane. Now, we could talk about Bernoulli's theorem. That's really what holds the plane up. But that's very abstract. It's very left brain. And all this left brain understanding doesn't seem to translate over very well to the emotional part of the brain on the right. So what this jelly idea is we're taking Bernoulli's theorem and trying to give the visual brain a way to look at it. So the jelly exercise is a one step forward. Second thing is you really need to understand that pilots cannot understand why anyone has trouble with flying because they know that the plane just doesn't have a problem with it. I've spent a lot of time trying to convince people about how safe flying is, and I can go through that. But I think a lot of the problem really comes from this idea that all of us learn that if we can keep something out of our minds, it won't bother us. Otherwise, why would we have a bar? You know, if we can go to the bar and blast our minds, we can feel pretty good about stuff for a few hours. But when you get on the airplane and you say, okay, my strategy for controlling my feelings is, well, I have to be in control. Well, I can't do that on the plane. Oh, okay, that's all right. My secondary strategy is if I can't control things, I want to be able to escape. I can't do that on the airplane either. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, then what have I got left? You've got that psychological escape. You get on the airplane and try to keep your mind off it. And you can do that maybe if it's nice and smooth. But when the turbulence starts shaking the plane, you can't keep your mind off of it. And so you're suddenly thrown back into being fully aware that you've got no control and no place to go. And then you maybe start thinking things are going to fall out of the sky. There's so much interaction between the emotional and the logic here. And some of your guys in the UK who've done some beautiful work in psychology on this, Fonagy and Bateman, talk about a thing called psychic equivalence. And what they mean by psychic equivalence is the psyche, the mind. Mm-hmm. What happens is that whatever you've got in mind is believed to be reality, absolutely, without question. Now, if I ask you, how do you know the difference between imagination and reality at any moment? You could say, oh, I don't know how I know, but I just know. That's because you're looking at your thinking process. Now, if you intentionally imagine something, it takes a certain amount of intention and effort to imagine something. So you know you're doing that. If you're not intentionally doing it, you figure it's reality. Now, that ability to look at your thinking, Fonagy and Bateman call it reflective function, the ability to look at your thinking, and therefore you know whether you're imagining or whether it's real. Now, the interesting thing is we don't develop reflective function until about 3 years old. Two-year-old kid doesn't have it. So if you got a three-year-old kid and a two-year-old kid playing together, three-year-old kid being able to know when he's imagining something can pretend. So he can say to the two-year-old, let's pretend we're in the jungle. And there's some lions and tigers. They got big mouths and big teeth, and they're going to try to chase us and eat us. Run. There's one coming after us now. The three-year-old can have fun with it because he knows it's not true. Mm. He knows he put that thought there. He knows he put that tiger there. But the two-year-old kid doesn't have reflective function. And as far as the two-year-old kid's concerned, that tiger in his mind is absolutely real, and he's going to go screaming for his mom to save him. Now, the same, unfortunately, what happens is with anxious flyers, we become like two-year-old kids. What happens is we lose our ability to reflect on our thinking and see that it's imagination.
Yeah.
And here's how it happens. this ability to have reflective function is fragile. And when we get enough stress hormones building up, we lose it. When we take alcohol, we lose it. When we take anti-anxiety drugs, we lose it. So any of those things can make your ability to distinguish the difference between reality and imagination go away. So here you are on the airplane, and if you imagine the plane is falling out of the sky, if you reflect the function, your ability to recognize that's imagination, if that's impaired due to stress hormones, due to anti-anxiety medications, or due to alcohol, or just the fact that you don't have very good reflective function to begin with, you're doomed. You've got to be sure that plane is falling out of the sky. You just know it's falling out of the sky, and no one can convince you otherwise. To a great extent, fear of flying problems and dealing with them is a contest to avoid psychic equivalents, to avoid letting your imagination masquerade as reality.
You know, I'm so impressed with the program because I think you've got such a good understanding of the psychology that's happening behind it. And then I think people are completely reassured by the fact that you're a pilot as well. And I also love the way that you're so interactive with people who use the program. Isn't that right? You have, I think you have a weekly chat that happens, yeah, and things like that. Isn't that,
yeah,
right?
And by the way, I wanted to tell you about that. You know, we have that at Block New York time that makes it really hard, maybe impossible, for anybody in your part of the world to do it. So what you and I have decided to do, which we could tell the listeners, is that since they can't, you see, in every one of our courses, we include a 20-minute session to make sure that the person sets up the exercise that trains the mind so it's going to work. And then we supplement it with that Wednesday night phone call. But since we can't do that effectively for people who would have to call us at 4 a.m. in the morning, we're going to add an additional counseling session to anyone who, through you, signs up to do the SOAR program.
Yeah, that's a great. And we said that to get that, they need to visit panicaway.com/SOAR. That's SOAR. And people will be able to avail of that. And that's two sessions, isn't that right? Plus the program.
Yeah, the sessions that I do with people in the U.S., I do one 20-minute session, but we're going to do two 30-minute sessions, or a total of an hour, however we do it, with the people who come to us through you.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, I really recommend anyone that is dealing with the fear of flying to give this program a try, because I have looked at different fear of flying programs and I don't think they go into any kind of detail or depth like yours does. And am I right in saying that I think other programs probably do well in the area of mild anxiety, but they don't really address people who've got a severe fear of flying, whereas yours does?
That's right. And the thing is that if you have a very mild problem, just anything you do to confront fear of flying, kind of like the way you confront panic, anything that you do at all can help if it's a mild problem. But the other courses are still at the same place that Slim Cummings was at back in 1975. They haven't added anything to it. Even, for example, the Virgin Atlantic course is still trying to say, hey, use relaxation exercises. They didn't even bother to go to the trouble of seeing that the research shows it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So what you find is pilots who are saying, hey, just understand how safe it is, that'll take care of it, it doesn't. And you've got people who are saying use relaxation exercises, it doesn't. And cognitive therapy, it helps some, but it doesn't help with those things that happen where the amygdala automatically releases stress hormones.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to explain it. I think people will have gotten a lot out of the call just from hearing, you know, the way you talk about how fear works when people are flying and different approaches they can take. And to remind the listeners that the special that Captain Tom Bunn is offering to Panic Away listeners is they can avail of it by visiting panicaway.com/SOAR. That's SOAR.
Thank you very much, Barry. I enjoyed talking with you, and I hope that people do get a lot out of it, whether they take the program or not. At least they know that help is available. So, look, you know, so many people, the hardest thing now is this. You know, it took us years to find out how to fix this problem and fix it for everybody. Now the problem is convincing people that it actually will work, because many times they've tried what they think is everything, but this does work.
And it's, you know, and a lot of the time I see it in my own area as well, is, if, you know, it's about taking action as well. I think sometimes people are a little bit afraid to take that initial action, you know, and you're addressing an issue. But, you know, I'd encourage people to go ahead and, you know, take that first step, find out, learn the information, and then it can really transform your life, particularly for people who've got flights coming up in the near future. You know, it'll be very valuable to them.
Yeah, I probably should mention, too, people wonder how long it takes. If you just have 4 or 5, even if you have 2 days, you can get a lot of benefit of it. But if you've got 5 to 10 days, you can go through the entire program and get all the results that perfect results when you fly.
Great. Well, thank you again. We've been talking with Captain Tom Bunn from SOAR, the Fear of Flying program.
Thank you, Barry.